Chapter 8. Say, are you a belly dancer? Hospice humor. As unlikely a source for humor as my profession may seem, which you would probably guess is about as funny as a funeral, I always have an eye out for comical angles. For one thing, as I am out and about visiting patients, I overhear plenty of what other people say on the way to and on the way back from the location I'm headed to. One day, I was walking down the long halls of an adult community. It was adorned with those safely innocuous resident-generated photographs of swans and sunsets and the like, to perk up the colorless walls. This hallway was the corridor that linked the nursing home section to the independent living section within the same building complex. Three ladies, who had at least a nodding acquaintance with each other, were strolling along the hallway, same as I was. Woman A said, "Huh?" to Woman B, who had apparently just said something to her. Woman C then said to both of them, "You know what? The word huh should be the password around this place." All laughed, including me. Woman A, taking in my unexpected relatively youthful presence, then addressed me. "You gotta have humor about these things, about not hearing, otherwise." She made the motion of drawing her finger across her throat. I gave a knowing laugh, as she had a more appropriate and sympathetic listener than she could have guessed. I had to stifle the impulse to say, "Boy, as a hospice chaplain, I know for real you sure got that right." There certainly was no reason to reveal my true identity, as that would have needlessly drawn their attention to when it would be their own turn for my unenviable services. That is a line practically no one wants to consciously stand in, no matter how long and slow it is. I say practically because my father used to ask me how old a patient was when I recounted my day's visits to him. If the patient were older than he figured that he had some decent amount of time left. If younger, then either he himself had been spared, or it was time to start getting nervous. I think it was the latter, because as he grew older, he stopped asking about my patients' ages, as the odds in his game of chance were getting slimmer. He also had stopped asking me how many had died in a given week. At any rate, at his 90th birthday party in 2011, he confided to me, "I'm not afraid of death. Death is peace." That remark had two pluses. It made me feel less afraid of my own demise, and I was glad he himself was not dreading his own. Besides overheard conversations, sometimes remarks intentionally directed at me can be comical. One day I had gone to one of my favorite lunch places, an independent health food store in Princeton called the Whole Earth Center, and for the first time ever in my 6 years of patronizing that store, the cashier asked if I was a senior citizen. I meekly said no, and even worse, she said, "Are you sure?" as she pointed to a discount for senior sign. I said no again, and she mumbled something about the connection between my gray hairs and wisdom. At the time of this event, I was 55. A friend of mine teased me for not taking advantage of her wanting to simply give me a discount, but at that moment, all I could think to myself was, "Phooey! How dare anyone compare me to the patients I see?" Aside from the nuances of the cashier's inner struggle to want to help me out financially versus the risk of implying I'm older than I look, this comment becomes funnier given what I heard about my appearance and manner later that same day. As is often the case when on the job, I dress in a long skirt, a blouse with shorter long sleeves, a necklace, and sensible shoes. I wear a fanny pack, and my ID badge hangs down from a string like a secondary necklace, ending in a cloth square with a plastic pocket for the ID itself. If you want to get technical, the string and pocket for the ID is called a lanyard. I also carry a cloth bag, which contains hand sanitizer, prayer booklet, and some papers about the patients I plan to see. I am also supposed to carry medical items, such as latex gloves and antiseptic wipes, but I do not bother. I purchased my current bag in Hope, Alaska, which pictures green salmon cavorting against a white background. That alone entertains patients and evokes many expressions of pleasure. After lunch, on the day of the senior incident, I had gone to one of the adult communities that contains various kinds of care, including a nursing home section and independent living units like the one I just described. As I was breezing along a corridor on the way to an apartment, dressed in a flowering chartreuse skirt and a blouse with splotches of varying blues and white and maroon, the same blouse you can see on About the Author page in the print version of this book, a denizen of the corridor called out,
"Say, are you a belly dancer?"
That more than made up for the health food whippersnapper's remark about my hypothesized citizenship among the elderly. Even better, later that same day, a hospice nurse was still there with one of my patients when I came by to visit. As she wrapped things up, like checking his blood pressure, the nurse said, "Oh, there's Karen. She's the one with the sense of humor." Now that is indeed high praise. Like telling a coal miner he's good at finding sources of light while on the job, or remarking that a funeral director is good at pointing out the bright side. As in any typical workplace, there is room for humor on the hospice agency bulletin board, too. You have your comic strips, your newspaper headlines with unintended puns, and your office party photos that you're glad no one else will ever see. In hospice, the humor about death tends to be gentle. Humor, keep in mind, is a relative term in my career. Do not expect to be rolling in the aisles. I'll settle for a fleeting smile. I recall a drawing that looked like this. It had a running line across the page. The word birth on the extreme left was marked with an X. The word death on the extreme right, likewise marked. And in the middle, the phrase, "You are here," with the biggest X of all. I remarked to a social worker who was happening by when I read this that the cartoonist must have been middle-aged. She added,
"It sure does make you think about things."
Another way humor can come into play in written form is in our documentation. One of the tasks of the hospice team is for each member to write some information down about each visit and then put it in the digital medical record. This is to make it official that we visited each patient a certain number of times and to show what we accomplished there. So for a nurse, documentation might help her make sure she had given the right dose of medicine to banish pain. She describes the amount given and by whom and whether there needs to be any changes in the doctor's orders. She can also describe any intractable problems that remain or new issues and her plan for what to do next. A social worker normally explains how she helped the family members cope better with patient care. Or she may list which community services she directed them to. For me, a clinical note often runs along the lines of how I let the clients vent and hoped for outcome for them of calm and comfort from having been heard. Or it might be about my offering prayer and hymns, or for a Catholic patient, about getting a priest to administer the sacrament of the sick. Sometimes it is just about making sure the patient is comfortable and letting the nurse know pronto if he's not. Each team member has access to all the other team members' notes on the computer, so we can keep informed and give the very best care. Well, one day I glanced at a social worker's note which said, now here it comes, the minuscule bit of humor. The patient was illegible. I'm sure she meant unintelligible. A much more obscure, pleasing resonance to me and other chaplains who may be reading this book is that in our training, we often refer to clients as living human documents. The gist of the idea is that we read what we can about the people we interact with so we can understand who they are and therefore how best to serve them. So if a patient were illegible, that could mean, if I take this metaphor further, that they were unreadable. Ah, well, this association led to a sad thought after all. Sometimes too many pages are torn out of a patient's autobiography to get a sense of them at all. Such is the elusiveness of hospice humor. To speak of patients as a document is an apt metaphor, because so much of what I do involves reading between the lines, to get at what the client hopes I will respond to, but for the sake of saving face, does not want to come out and say explicitly. Or as the American psychoanalyst Theodore Reich put it, I have to listen with a third ear. You may remember the case of the patient named Bob, his wife Jill, and the devout friend Anna, who prayed for and preached at length to the couple. See Chapter 3. After Bob's death, Jill said yes to my offer to come over and visit her. As you may recall, we members of the hospice team can make ourselves available to call or visit the bereaved for up to a year, for 13 months to be exact. Usually, survivors take me up on this offer when they want to vent their feelings or simply want information about what to expect as their grief journey lies ahead. When I went to see Jill, she did not want to discuss either of those things. We sat and drank tea and ate cookies, talking about nothing in particular, and having a great time schmoozing. I was happy enough to be invited to high tea and have a respite from intense conversation. But I was puzzled as to why she wanted me to come over. I finally asked her if she had anything particular on her mind, and she said no. She even embarrassed me by asking whether I only could make visits when there was a problem to discuss, but still left me wondering why she wanted me to come. I wondered what I was offering that her friends and family were not. They, too, had been visiting her regularly. About a month later, I called to see whether she wanted another visit and promised that I would just be there to enjoy high tea with her again. At the visit, after a brief discussion of a family problem, we once again just enjoyed chatting. Something she said tipped me off that the message I was to read between the lines of this human document was simply, "I'm lonely for a person who just wants to enjoy my company." Sometimes I'm looking for deep, complicated reasons for things, so the joke was on me that she simply wanted companionship. Since she did have other visitors, a footnote to her text was probably, "And since you're a clergywoman, it's like having God drop by for tea and cookies and juicy gossip." As for her devout friend, who had also continued to visit, maybe Jill wanted me, too, so that I could just represent God being in the moment with her, without any agenda to persuade or convince her of anything. Another venue where humor can rear its pretty head is at the interdisciplinary team meetings. These are usually super serious, weekly discussions of the patients, in which funny remarks and even gallows humor are a welcome comic relief. Every week or two, the whole team sits together with a doctor and clinical supervisor to go over the whole list of patients to review what they might need and to give the team a more holistic view of each. We also get up to speed on information such as who is rapidly deteriorating or who might graduate, that is, go off hospice if they are continuing to remain stable or even improve. These meetings can overwhelm us since almost always we are hearing about one doomed case after another, with all the attendant physical, emotional, and spiritual gory details. So along with the impending death itself, we sometimes have to hear about such things as family members leaving a patient alone all day, presence of guns in the home, intractable pain, and recent or impending deaths of other family members besides the patient. Especially for chaplains and social workers who do so much listening all day already, we may want to just stop up our ears and indulge in ignorance as bliss. So when something incongruous crops up, we all laugh like crazy. Laughter is our sweet escape hatch. At one such meeting, the nurse was describing a peculiar family. She said each time she visited there, she would bonk into a low-lying chandelier on the way in.
The funny part is that instead of raising the goddamn chandelier, the guy's wife wrapped it with bubble paper so that when we visit, it won't hurt as much. As much! Can you get that?
You probably aren't consumed with fits of giggles, but then again, unless you're a hospice worker, you do not need as much of an excuse to burst into laughter. We will stoop to laughing at just about anything, which means the humor can be quite dark. You might want to skip the rest of this paragraph and the next two if you're a gentle soul or recently lost a loved one on hospice. One of the things we mention a lot during the interdisciplinary team meetings is how much weight each patient has lost in the past few weeks or months. This is an important indicator as to whether a patient should continue receiving hospice care, meaning she should if she is not stabilized for the long term or even improved. So once in a while, team members on the heavy side will sigh and wistfully say, "Ah, the hospice diet, I should try that." Another time I induced the humor myself. At one of the hospices I had worked for, United Hospice of Rockland, the custom was for the chaplain to offer an opening prayer or inspirational reading to set a respectful tone. Since my singing was sought after even by staff, I would offer a religious but not too religious song, such as, "He's got the whole world in his hands." I say not too religious, as I had to keep in mind the diversity of religions or absence of religion of the team members. Well, one time, after several days of record humid 95-degree weather, instead of the expected solemn hymn, I rang out with the 1945 Christmas carol, "Let It Snow." That evoked a prolonged chorus of laughter. Then there was the time I unintentionally made a very bad pun, but fortunately just to my husband Stephen and not to the grieving family. It was about 12 degrees Fahrenheit with winds gusting to 30 miles an hour, and I had to do a graveside funeral. When it is cold outside, a cemetery feels colder than the reported weather conditions, because it's a wide open space with plenty of room for wind to cavort in and for chilling thoughts to discomfort us. When I spoke with the deceased son about his preferences, he readily agreed that because of the extreme cold, the funeral should be mercifully brief. As I prepared the ceremony, I felt torn between sufficiently acknowledging the loss by including all the most essential prayers and not making the mourners and me suffer from the, so to speak, bone-chilling cold. Now that is a pun too, but what I was thinking of is that as I described this conflict of doing a proper ceremony versus not making the people physically miserable, I said to Steve, "I guess I'll have to do a bare-bones funeral." As soon as I said it, I realized how awful that sounded, and as I said, it did not reach the ears of the people involved. Nevertheless, I could not resist a wicked smile to myself at the thought, nor, as you can see, could I resist including it here. But please do not be too outraged at these reminiscences of dark, if not downright disturbing humor, because sometimes the families themselves indulge in comedy that flirts with sacrilege, and they laugh just as loudly. One such family and I were at the graveside. The deceased had moved from one displeasing dwelling to another many times in her life. As they were reminiscing, her sister said, addressing herself to the grave,
"Well, Madge, this'll be the last apartment you'll be moving to. You better be satisfied that it's a good one, because it's gonna be the very last."
It's a wonder that she did not praise the long-term cheap rental rates. A more intricate case involved a patient and wife who had a sense of humor that was so contrarian, it fooled the hospice team into thinking the patient had been abusive to the spouse. On the contrary, humor that now and then bordered on sarcasm and irony spiced up their relationship as far as I could judge. Malcolm could dish it out, but Becky could sure send it sailing right back. As he spoke to me, Malcolm made many ironical comments about his ticker and his impending end, smiling and with eyes flashing as if it were all a ruse. I think he was playfully daring me to feel uncomfortable about referring so casually and indifferently to his prospective cardiac demise. Meanwhile, Becky tried to dismiss his hints of being heaven-bound as absurdly premature. Becky took Malcolm outdoors from time to time in the car to give him a break from just endlessly sitting and sitting in his easy chair. They would see some park or go to a drive-in window to pick up some simple fare. One fine day, the final day it turned out, she took him to a McDonald's. He ordered a burger and proceeded to eat it in the car on the return trip. They did not both make it back, at least not the whole way back. Mid-trip, burger consumed, he leaned sideways and his ticker timed out and ticked its last tick. When I saw Becky several weeks later, as devastated as she was and guilt-ridden for having taken him out of the house and tired him, we both could not help bursting out laughing at what a terrible burger he must have eaten. I simultaneously thought to myself how in my college days, those of us who were passionate about health food had given the local burger chef the moniker Burger Death. Related to humor on the job are discussions that are not funny, but are ironic or incongruous enough to be darkly amusing. It was the last day of April, and a couple I was visiting for the first time gaily invited me to sit with them on their outdoor deck overlooking their flower-filled garden. The patient and his wife just wanted to be in the moment, so I chit-chatted about the kinds of flowers and trees in the garden and about the history of their dead-end street. They had plenty to say, having lived there for over 50 years and possibly married for even longer. So I did not have to say much to prime the pump for conversation. The patient, who loved gardening, morosely alluded to his no longer being able to tend it. His wife then pointed to a neighbor's rotting tree, some of its branches jutting into their own property.
"I don't like dead things," she asserted. "They should be removed. See that tree?"
She gestured to a great big one in the center of their garden.
"It's pretty much dead. I'm afraid it'll have to go. It'll be such a big loss. We've already had to cut off so many of its branches. I hate to see it go. We've had it for such a long time."
I thought to myself, how could she say she does not like dead things? Here she is, unaware that her talking about death and removal and big losses was foreshadowing another sort of big loss. Right next to her was sitting a man who himself was slated, so to speak, to be removed as well. Sometimes humor arises out of challenged assumptions. One assumption the team makes too hastily is that when we visit patients, they will be thinking of profound things like the meaning of their lives, or last words they want to say, or how to prepare for death. The reality is a patient often will want to talk about everyday trivia, treating their last days much like all the preceding ones, as if to say, "I'm just as much alive today as I have been any other day." One of my open-ended questions I use to signal that I'm here to listen is, "What are you thinking about now?" I ask this of a supremely intelligent man who had been a lawyer. Ralph had imparted many wise lessons to me. He whispered,
"If you were to have just the judge decide a case, he would often come up with the same decision as a whole jury."
He was bedbound, and he whispered so softly that his voice was soft even by whispering standards. When I asked what he was thinking about, he often mentioned music because he knew I could sing, and he liked me to do so. He was so knowledgeable about music, and his memory so perfect, that eventually he grew tired of my limited repertoire over my many visits, and he asked,
"Don't you have anything else you could sing?"
At any rate, it was around the end of March when I asked him again what he was thinking about, and as I leaned in to hear his momentous thought, he replied,
"Federal taxes."
And not only that, he informed me that
estimated taxes help the economy.
The incongruity of a dying man talking about the intricacies of our tax code made me think of Benjamin Franklin's assertion that in this world, Nothing is certain except death and taxes. How is it that I have ferreted out quirky stories like these in such an unlikely setting as hospice care? On the most superficial level, I think humor is a way to enjoy life even when we become very conscious that we can no longer take being alive for granted. I have often used humor to give patients and their families momentary relief from all the oppressively serious things on their minds. When I introduce myself, I frequently take advantage of the sing-song coupling of my last name with my title, Chaplain Kaplan, which is good for a laugh, especially if I accompany it with a sly smile. I once wrote a fictitious verbatim dated April 1, 1998, where the patient quips, "And if your last name were Chaplin, as in Charlie Chaplin, you'd be Chaplain Chaplin." Whenever possible, I highlight something patients and family members say, such as an unintentional pun, and make them laugh. Being receptive to spontaneous sources of humor inherent in the very nature of human interaction gives me a break, too, from the forbidding seriousness of it all. Still, it seems that I utilize humor to a greater extent than most hospice chaplains. After all, I have a reputation among staff for being funny. What might the deeper reasons for that be? In one respect, I am comfortable with distancing myself enough from a situation to see it from multiple perspectives, and thereby not have much of a stake in it one way or the other. Even more basically than that, I take what I just said about distancing myself, and I think about how I have done that before. As a child, I was socially on the outside, and that was what I was used to, not that I ever liked it. When the playground lines formed after recess, I was always the last one in line. If there were an odd number of children, then I did not even have a partner in the last spot. When I did, that child did his best to let me know he was beside me only under duress. On the one hand, my isolation made me sad and lonely. But on the other, I could take in details that people on the inside were too enmeshed in to be aware of. In the end, this ability as an adult to get outside of a situation so I could look at it more objectively endowed me with the means to undo the lack of nurture at home that garbled my social language beyond recognition. This isolation, coupled with my misunderstood or even unacknowledged listening disorder, pushed me toward introversion. I think the subversive side of humor has some connection with my distancing tendencies as well. Humor can challenge the status quo. It appends assumptions and therefore can threaten those in charge. When I sang "Let It Snow" during that hot day at the team meeting, my colleagues laughed in merriment, but not our supervisor. She apparently took my act as too cavalier toward her desired atmosphere for the meeting. So for good or ill, that supervisor eventually let me go. My sense of humor has provided another means of keeping my distance from the mainstream, even if that mainstream itself, the hospice agency, is off the mainstream of society in general. As a result, as a jocular hospice chaplain, I have been living on the edge of the edge.